Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Inside the Football Business, where we talk about the business of the game of football. And as always, with me is Neil Stratton from Inside the League. Neil, how's it going this morning?
It's going great, Justin. Great talking to you. It's good to get into our show.
Yep, that's for sure. And so, obviously, we're to the third preseason game. Next weekend, we kick off college football, and the weekend after that, the NFL kicks off. So, we're kind of right into the mix of the season. But as always, there's a lot of business aspects of things that, you know, go on in the NFL and some other, you know, things that we're going to talk about. But the first couple topics we wanted to talk about in regards to number one is the Joey Bosa situation. It's kind of taken, you know, a life of its own. You know, the San Diego Chargers had released some press releases that basically said they were an impasse, that they weren't going to do anything more. It was kind of there. We've seen LaDainian Tomlinson, you know, kind of come out and say, hey, guys, got to get into a camp, you know, and other people kind of, hey, try to see if Bosa could get in there. Now, really, the, you know, again, we've talked about, hey, the offset language and the kind of the money deferral there. But, I, you know, if we look at this, basically now the situation is, okay, it's the third preseason week's this week, and then everybody turns around, plays the game on Thursday, and then they roll into getting their 53-man roster there and then to, you know, to off to the regular season. So, basically, you know, the deadline is if Bosa fails to sign with the Chargers before November 15th, they retain his rights through the end of the 2016 season, and he won't be able to play. So there's I think, the real deadline, which is the Tuesday after week 10, you know, there. So that's kind of the deadline there. So they wouldn't be able to trade him and things like that. And really, right now, you know, they can't trade him because that window had already passed Tuesday, August 9th. So if they don't sign him by November 15th, then he basically rolls in and enters the 2017 draft. Now, many people think that is unlikely, but that's kind of the scenario. And so, Neil, what's your take on this, and who do you think blinked first, you know, there, Bosa, CAA, or the San Diego Chargers?
Well, I don't think anyone's blinked yet, obviously. There's no resolution here, and it's kind of become interesting how this has unfolded. We're actually doing a little research on that for today's Friday wrap, our email that goes out to everyone, talking about how holdups have materialized in the last, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, really. The whole idea of the latest CBA was to essentially eliminate the holdout. And so this is a bit of a surprise. Obviously, the Chargers are asking for him to defer a significant amount of money, and the always popular offset language has become an issue. It looks like Bosa is trying to make some concessions, but the Chargers are going for a full win here. And that's mildly surprising. I think both teams have gambled a bit that a defensive player can probably wait a little while longer than others, perhaps a quarterback or a running back or someone who's plays offense and has to know a little bit more about the playbook. At the same time, it's not just a snap to cut to step right in and play. So I think at this point, as late as we are, you know, given that this is, we've got dress rehearsals coming up, the third week, I think preseason is always the most meaningful one. We're starting to get into the area where it really does impede on the season. Now, if Bosa were to sit out through November, if both sides are hardened that much, boy, you know, that would be another real surprise. I don't expect that to happen. I guess I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop and for him to come into camp and for one team to kind of blink. But right now, I guess I'd answer your question by saying neither team has blinked, and that's why we are where we are. The stakes are not getting a lot higher, I guess, you know, technically, given the fact that the deadline is still a good ways off and the trade deadline has passed. So I guess there's not a really big reason for either side to come in immediately, except that obviously both want to kind of get some value out of this money for Bosa and playing time for the Chargers. So I don't see an obvious marker that's going to give either team leverage or push either one to get even more serious about things, especially if the Bosa team is ready to kind of just take a match to the season. I don't have any insights there as far as whether or not that's the case. I guess I'm just kind of sitting on the sidelines like everyone else and following the drama, which is considerable. So I expect something to happen the next week just because it's getting so late. But if it doesn't happen in the next week, then this really could go into the season, and I really don't know why it wouldn't.
Yeah, and some things that, you know, that have kind of had brought up, you know, and some things to talk about is the San Diego Chargers obviously are looking to get a new deal in San Diego. So, and they're looking for public funding money from the city of San Diego to be able to build a new stadium. And if not, you know, they have the option to go to the Rams site there in Inglewood. And I don't think that's something that the Spanos family wants to do. So is this deferral of, hey, we're taking a hard stance, we're, you know, because they want to talk about, you know, cash flow issues on the deferral, you know, there of some of his signing bonuses. Is this a PR, you know, thing going, hey, to try to, you know, get more money? I don't know because obviously, I mean, some guys, you know, some teams have given, you know, their first round picks, you know, basically all, you know, all the money up front, like the Baltimore Ravens with Ronnie Stanley. So I think that, you know, could that play into it? Maybe obviously they're trying to get a, you know, a stadium deal done and trying to figure out where they're going to be there. But also when you look at it, and you'd have to run the math, and I haven't done that, but let's say Joey Bosa does sit out. He gets paid nothing this year. And now he enters in the 2017 draft. And now would there be some type of collusion with all 32 teams to kind of ice him out of, you know, the first round and, you know, and then go, okay, hey, this guy, we're going to send a message, and he loses, you know, he loses a ton of money because he decided to, you know, hey, I want my money now, and hey, we're going to do some offset language stuff there. Could that be a possibility where he ends up coming up losing big money?
Well, I think that's interesting speculation, but I think the will to win is too great for teams to be willing to do that just to kind of prove a point. I mean, short of him being involved in a murder investigation a la Lyle Collins, you very rarely see all 32 teams act in concert. And I mean, it has really seriously be in their best interest to stay away from a situation. And so I'd be surprised if something like that happened. You know, it's, I guess the one other point I'll make is it's rare to see something like this happen in such a public fashion. I mean, with the Chargers essentially putting out a statement, completely defending their position and to some degree really kind of excoriating Bosa and his representatives, that's somewhat rare and an interesting choice by the Chargers. I know they're trying to, as you alluded to, kind of keep their fan base at bay and try to keep them on their side. And they're going to need that as they kind of weigh their options with respect to moving the team. It seems highly unusual for them to go out and really specify, well, we did this and we did that and we did this, and we did that. And he still isn't interested and really kind of, I don't know, put it in terms that, I don't know if I want to say it will have lasting effects, because ultimately when, you know, whenever this is resolved, everything's going to move on and there'll be a lot more goodwill, especially if Bosa performs well, but it's just an interesting step. I normally lean more towards management in these matters, but I don't understand fully outside of trying to win a PR war, why the Chargers would do such a thing. But, you know, obviously everyone has their, a right to do the things that they feel is best for their franchise.
Yeah, and, you know, again, I mean, he's represented by CAA, so obviously they have, you know, a ton of clients there in the NFL. My question, you know, on that is, are they, you know, is it Bosa, and I don't know this, is it Bosa instructing CAA, or the CAA instructing the bosses, going, "Hey, we can stick it, you know, like let's stick it out. You know, they'll give in to our demand and stuff like that." Like that we don't know, and that hasn't been put out there in regards to kind of who's driving that bus. You know, is it, you know, and obviously CAA is, you know, has a wealth of experience and knowledge, so. You know, but again, they also work for their client, and you know, so you don't know kind of who's kind of steering that bus there.
Well, you know, traditionally the player is the boss of the agents, and if bosses say, "Hey, look, get me into camp," I think, you know, again, traditionally the CAA is going to try to make the best deal and then go. But I don't know. I guess this could be a situation where the tail's wagging the dog. I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, again, there's a lot we could speculate on, but it's kind of hard to know exactly what's going on there.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, another team that is looking to move, and that is the Oakland Raiders. Obviously, you know, the Raiders has had, you know, they've been in LA, moved to Oakland, excuse me, started in Oakland, moved to LA, and then back to Oakland. You know, and now maybe they're going to really be the Las Vegas Raiders. The Raiders filed to trademark the Las Vegas Raiders, and also filed for 3 trademarks to the phrase Las Vegas Raiders this week. They've also done some renderings to a 65,000 seat dome stadium, you know, that's going to be kind of off the Vegas Strip. They basically are holding fast that they're not negotiating with the city of Las Vegas. There needs to be $750 million. Right now, they think the price tag of this stadium that they're looking to build, and they have 2 different sites just west of the Las Vegas Strip that they're looking at. It's going to cost them about $1.9 billion. You know, and it's involved with some different, casino owners and obviously then the Las Vegas, community and the Oakland Raiders. Then the Raiders would be pitching about $500 million toward building, you know, that new stadium there. It'd be owned by the city of Las Vegas, and then the Raiders would then rent that there. But, you know, there'd be obviously some concessions that the Raiders would get on a financial standpoint there. So this is looking more and more like this might be, you know, a move. I mean, it doesn't look like, you know, the city of Oakland is really ponying up there. I know it's basically a 50-minute flight from Oakland or the San Francisco area down to Las Vegas. Las Vegas, in regards to about estate taxes, a lot cheaper than there in California. Obviously, Las Vegas is the entertainment capital of the world, you know, or that's what they like to claim there. You know, so this Neil looks like it's going to be something that's going to most likely get done if the city of Las Vegas is willing to give them the money there. And, you know, is that a good move for the NFL? I think, you know, there'll be a chance to be Super Bowls there, you know, and it will be a prime, you know, destination for events like the Super Bowl, you know, there. Same thing with in LA, what they're building there. But is it good for, you know, the kind of that storied franchise to move into a new state, into Las Vegas, which obviously doesn't have it wouldn't be a huge market. It's, you know, kind of the size of Jacksonville and Green Bay, you know, and kind of it's a transit. There's not like these people that live in Las Vegas have come from other places. So do you think it's a good move for the Raiders and the NFL to have a team there in Las Vegas?
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting aspects of it. You allude to the fact, let's set aside the gambling issue for right now. You mentioned the fact that it's a market that is not the size that the NFL would normally like to move into. So that's an issue. Another issue is if it's built with essentially public money, or at least not with Raiders money as much, will the NFL decide to put a Super Bowl there? I mean, I think that's one of the underlying storylines here is, you know, because typically, as we've seen Super Bowls in places like Detroit and Indianapolis and now Minnesota coming up soon, places where typically, even New York, places that are pretty cold in January and February, and places where the NFL would typically put a game are they going to go by their rule and, or I guess their unspoken rule, and put a game in Las Vegas? I mean, if Las Vegas ponies up a lot of money and they do move, is it going to, you know, I mean, putting a game in the gambling capital of the world would seem to be against almost everything the NFL has tried to stand for. So that's another interesting kind of storyline. What, I mean, obviously the Raiders are no stranger to litigation against the league. Will there be litigation? Who gets, if there is, will there, I mean, I guess there's essentially no way the league can stop the Raiders, but I'm sure that they won't take this line down, I presume, anyway. Now, again, perhaps I'm wrong. Maybe I'm reading this wrong. The national attitudes about gambling have changed in the past 5 to 10, really 20 years. So maybe this is something that is, something that's bound to happen eventually, and owners are just going to say, well, I guess there's nothing we can do about it. We'll just try to be, really keep our thumb on them and make sure gambling stays separate from that. But I don't know if that's possible or how they could really regulate that or step in and kind of build walls. That's obviously, the city of Las Vegas is attached at the hip to the gambling business, and that's something the NFL has always tried to steer clear of. But at the same time, the league has certainly embraced fantasy football and even DFS. So the line is a lot more blurry than it was, let's say, even 10 years ago. And so I guess this is something that is becoming a reality and maybe something Roger Goodell is going to have to accept.
Yeah, I think the standpoint is, you know, Jerry Jones is a guy who kind of helps move the needle in the NFL, and he's been a very successful, businessman as well as successful with the NFL business. And he's kind of come out to the proponent of, hey, this would be a great thing to have an NFL club in Las Vegas. So I think with him kind of on board there, I think we'll see, you know, he kind of, like I said, he helped basically get the, you know, Inglewood project done there in L.A. when they were going to go to that other, you know, the Raiders and the Chargers project. He kind of helped Stan Kroenke, you know, kind of woo the owners to say, hey, go with this, you know, project there in Inglewood and have the Rams go from St. Louis to L.A. So I think Jerry Jones holds a lot of weight in that owner's room there. And I think, hey, if he kind of puts his stamp of approval, I think we'll see more of those 32, you know, kind of lean his way there. So, but it's going to be interesting. You know, I think it's something where, you know, hey, would it help the NFL in regards to building their kind of national brand, because a lot of, you know, foreigners do come to Las Vegas. I mean, that's a, you know, it's a tourist, you know, city there. So does that help build some of the NFL brand? And is that something that they're looking at, you know, in regards to kind of, you know, signing off on the gambling aspect, kind of the waiver there of being in the gambling capital of the United States. So, but again, it'll be interesting to see. I think we're, you know, this is just another couple of steps towards kind of getting the Raiders from Oakland to, you know, Las Vegas. So that'll definitely be an interesting thing to watch there. But
well,
one
more point on that is, you know, with Los Angeles filled now as a market, there isn't an obvious place where teams could land. I think if the Raiders wind up not going there for whatever reason, this isn't the last we're going to hear about Las Vegas, because they're going to continue to look for teams, and every team that's trying to get negotiating leverage over its own lease is probably going to start pointing to Las Vegas. So again, you know, I think this is, if somehow the miraculous the Raiders don't move there, there are going to be other teams that are probably making headlines about maybe moving there.
Yeah. And a team that we've talked about a number of times, they made a move yesterday with the Cleveland Browns trading their number 6 pick in the 2013 draft, Barkevious Mingo, to the New England Patriots for a 5th round. And now the New England Patriots hold obviously the 6th and the 7th pick from the 2013 draft, which is quite disappointing. With they have Barkevious Mingo and Jonathan Cooper there. So what would you know, obviously, you know, the Cleveland Browns are kind of saying, kind of stockpiling draft picks. There was some talk earlier in the week, maybe Josh Gordon was, you know, is, was he on the market there, and if should they trade him there? But going back to the 2013 draft, you know, this is another guy who, you know, has moved teams. If you look at the top 10 of this draft, it's very underwhelming, to say the least.
Well, you know, let's go through the top 10. The Chiefs took Eric Fisher, obviously. The Jags took Luke Jokel. The Dolphins took Deion Jordan. The Eagles took Lane Johnson. And the Lions take Ezekiel Ansah. Of the top five, really, I think there's only one standout, and that will be Ansah, the defensive end for the Lions. Lane Johnson's been solid, had his option picked up, instead of Eric Fisher. You know, the two and three players, Luke Jokel and Deion Jordan, I think we can safely call busts. I mean, they don't haven't had their options picked up, which is a good way of kind of grading that. Then you go and look at 6 through 10. The Browns took Barkevius Mingo, who just got traded, as you mentioned. The Cardinals took Jonathan Cooper, another guy who's been traded, which is amazing. Again, two players traded to 6 and 7 picks just 3 years later have already changed teams. The Rams took Tavon Austin, who hasn't been an impact player. Dean Milner with the Jets has been on and off, in and out of the starting lineup. And then Chance Womack with the Titans, who's been, I think, solid, but certainly no star. If you go down and look at the rest of the first round, 14 players haven't had their option picked up. I mean, that's shocking that almost half the players selected in the first round have essentially been deemed players we don't want anymore by NFL teams. And when you're selecting the first round, you like to get a guy who sticks around and starts for you for 10 years. And I think that's something reasonable to expect, but, you know, not so in 2013. And I don't know that there's a reason why that took place. I mean, if you look at the teams that these players came from, I mean, the lion's share coming from big conferences. Obviously, the top pick didn't. Eric Fisher came out of Central Michigan. But we're not looking at a lot of D2 and FCS players. You're not looking at a number of odd positions like, you know, maybe kicker or what have you. I mean, they're all pretty mean potatoes. A lot of teams took offensive linemen that year. Maybe a bit of an outlier, but offensive linemen tend to be safer picks. They usually stick around longer and tend to satisfy. Why this happened? I mean, I don't know. I guess you could do a whole study on 2013 and try to figure out why it was kind of a bust year, but really across the board, it was a disappointment.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that, you know, teams are always trying to figure out, hey, what happened? And, you know, obviously people grade the draft kind of right immediately, but it's really you got to wait till, you know, 3-4 years out to see, hey, what these guys really are. And a guy like Ezekiel Ansah, who, you know, was kind of a project, and many people were questioning, hey, you know, should he go this high? You know, he's probably been the best player, you know, in regards to if you redrafted, he's probably the number one pick, you know, in the 2013 draft there. So, you know, so interesting, you know, and obviously we're rolling into the 2017 draft, and in the draft that we had last year or this past April, the New York Jets took Christian Hackenberg from Penn State in the second round. Here's a question, you know, is who took a bigger leap of faith, the Jets taking Hackenberg in the second round or the Houston Texans signing Brock Osweiler, who had 7 starts in his career? You know, I really think, you know, when you look have to look at it, I mean, a second-round pick, it's not a huge, you know, leap of faith there. But to pay the money that the Houston Texans paid Brock Osweiler, who didn't start a ton of games, and who their current team, who lost Peyton Manning, you know, wasn't willing to ante up and go as high as that. I think that's a huge leap of faith. It reminds me of, and obviously I'm going to date myself, Scott Mitchell signing with the Detroit Lions after he kind of came in from Dan Marino. And the Lions gave him a huge deal, and he was okay, but he was never the guy who was going to get them over the hump when they had Barry Sanders, Herman Moore, you know, Chris Spielman, et cetera, there. And I think, to me, Brock Osweiler is this generation Scott Mitchell.
Well, that's an excellent parallel. I think it takes geeks like me and you to really appreciate Scott Mitchell and what he meant and, you know, how he had a little success coming in for Dan Marino that year, and he kind of parlayed it into a big deal. I think there are a lot of similar parallels there and both really interesting case studies. I kind of lean more towards the Jets because I think had the Jets played their hand correctly, then they would have had Ryan Fitzpatrick in a lot sooner. I realized that they had to be careful, given the fact that Fitzpatrick has really been an up-and-down type player, and he's far from a savior. But he was their obvious he was kind of their obvious default quarterback all the way along, and there weren't a lot of quarterbacks on the market. And once Paxton Lynch had been selected and late in the first, there weren't any obvious choices. Hackenberg was a guy that I think surprised some teams by coming out early, and there was a certain amount of doubt, I guess, about would he be ready. And I think based on what we've seen in the preseason and practices for the Jets, he still does have a little ways to go. And so why the Jets didn't take someone who's a little bit more ready for the game and perhaps had the ability to step in and be a viable star in the draft, you know, I guess is something that question that only the Jets could answer. Given what we've seen of Hackenberg so far, then the money hasn't been a big roll of the dice, but he's looking more and more like he's probably headed for a redshirt season. The Jets are discussing carrying four quarterbacks, given the fact they've got Bryce Petty and Geno Smith on the roster, in addition to Fitzpatrick, of course. So, you know, given the fact that they took Hackenberg when they really had a kind of a glaring need there, given the fact that they had drafted Bryce Petty the year before, given the fact that Geno Smith was still on the roster, I don't know. I think if they had it all to do all over again, maybe they would have managed their roster a little bit differently. Hackenberg certainly has a future. I think he's got some exciting prospects, and he looks like somebody who could be a player down the line, but we don't know right now. That kind of instability at quarterback is something you don't often see. And to some degree, the Jets have gambled a little, and we'll see if their gamble pays off.
Yeah, the only thing I would counter that point is that, you know, a second-round pick, you know, in regards to the money, it's not a huge impact. You know, it's not a huge cap hit there. You know, Brock Osweiler, if he, you know, doesn't do what he had, they've had an albatross around their neck, with a contract like that. And we've seen, you know, contracts hamstring, you know, franchises from kind of going forward there. So it'll be interesting to see how things play out there. One thing where we got a couple minutes left to see this Tuesday, the Major League Baseball will be at a workout for none other than quarterback Heisman Trophy winner Tim Tebow. And, you know, that's an interesting thing. He's an older guy, you know, now trying to, you know, go play baseball after a kind of a failed football career. Obviously, he was a pick, had some early success, and then, you know, kind of waned there. But, you know, do we think he'll get signed? And then do we think that the NFL would ever do something, you know, like this for somebody that kind of failed at one sport and was willing to try to give the NFL a shot?
Well, you know, given the fact that Tim Tebow was a first-round pick, I mean, he's got athleticism. But it's a real question mark, given the fact that he's already kind of washed out in one career and he's not a spring chicken anymore, and he's essentially doing this on a lark. I mean, he doesn't have a background, a lengthy history in baseball. He doesn't baseball, I guess, is probably a little harder than it looks, perhaps. And these kind of workouts are set up to make you look like you're shining like a diamond. I mean, they'll play with strengths, and I'm sure he'll run well, and I'm sure he'll do different things that, you know, he'll be able to take batting practice and maybe knock a couple out of the park. But, you know, I think to some degree this is a measure of how analytics have intruded into every sport, from Major League Baseball, where it kind of started, to the NFL. And I think there's a perception now that if you've got the right metrics, you can be turned into a player. And I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think Tim Tebow is probably one of the top athletes that we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years in any sport, but I don't know that necessarily translates to making that kind of a jump. That's a sizable jump.
Yeah, so, well, again, it's great to be with you on a Friday morning, talking a little bit about the NFL and the business of aspects of that, as well as some other topic there. So, with 30 seconds, anything that you want to kind of get out there to the listeners?
Well, again, today we're going to, in Friday, in our Friday wrap, we'll be talking about the kind of the history of holdouts, especially with respect to San Diego, but also top players and kind of, you know, where they've decided, what kind of factors have moved that along. We'll also be working to put together our list next week for as the big cuts come in, and that's kind of showdown day for the 75 and that 53-man rosters.
Cool. We have a great week, and we'll talk to you next weekend.
Thanks, Justin. See you later.